four Irish lads are waking up in a German campsite. The night before was good crack, but they're feeling it this morning. But it's time to pack up and hit the road again, as they still have 4 or 5 more hours to Stuttgart. They're on the kind of adventure that only comes with following the Republic of Ireland. They have to reach Stuttgart before the afternoon. The Irish team itself was on its own adventure. And it was just the beginning for a national team that for so long had endured the heartbreak and near misses. We had to sit by and see our near neighbours of Wales, Scotland, England and Northern Ireland have their moments in the sun. Now, finally, it was our turn. Under the management of Jack Charlton, he had gotten Ireland to play a simple yet effective style. You put him under pressure. And who could have seen what lay ahead when the no-nonsense Northumbrian took the reins as manager? The drought would be over, and Irish fans in their tens of thousands would drink every moment in. But little did any of them know that Euro 88 was just the beginning of the adventures. Ones that etched themselves into our footballing psyche so much we know them simply by the place. Stuttgart, Genoa, Giant Stadium, and it all began with Jack Charlton getting the job. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, along with our football historian and traveller on those great Irish adventures, Gary Spain. Coming up on this week's show, we look at Jack Charlton getting the Ireland job and how he beat Bob Paisley, yes, that Bob Paisley from the great Liverpool team, to the job. We also look at how we made it to Euro 88, the players, the build-up, what was it like to travel to it and getting around the tournament, and what it meant after the tournament had finished. Remember, you can listen to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, YouTube and Amazon Music, as well as a host of other platforms too. Share the show on your social media platforms to help others learn about the history and heritage of Irish football. So, let's get on with this week's show. So, Gary, the last time we left off with the Irish football team, it was heartbreak in Brussels. It was near misses, and then we kind of fell away then under Owen Hand in the last few matches of his tenure. So, what happens in those last two games against Norway, and where do we find ourselves at the point? Is Owen Hand, is he asked to leave, or does he walk?
Effectively, his tenure was coming to an end.
Yeah.
So his contract was up. I mean, the Denmark game, we were beaten 4-1 at home by Denmark, which was totally embarrassing at the time. And it was pretty humiliating. There was an incident before the game when a journalist had said he was quicker than Mick McCarthy. And there was a race arranged for charity, and Mick McCarthy pulled his hamstring in the race and couldn't play the next day. I mean, it was pretty much a low ebb. So I think Owen's contract was not renewed, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong on that, but I think there was without doubt his time was coming to an end.
So where does the search begin then? Is there managers in the frame, and how do we find ourselves steering towards Jack Charlton?
So there was a subcommittee appointed. I think Des Casey was the main man to go to England and interview a number of people. So, obviously, Jack Charlton was interviewed. A number of people interviewed, like Liam Toohey was in the frame, Johnny Giles was in the frame, Gordon Lee, the former Everton manager, Paddy Mulligan was in the frame. There was a number of other names. Theo Foley was in the frame as well. And I'm probably forgetting one or two. Now, a man whose name wasn't in the frame was Bob Paisley. Now, Bob Paisley had been the legendary Liverpool manager, had won the most successful Liverpool manager of all time, and had won 3 of the 6 European Cups that Liverpool have won. Mm. So, but he was being talked about. So a number of interviews were conducted, and at the time, there was a lot of, how would I say, infighting in the FAI as well. So a short list was drawn up of Jack Charlton, Liam Toohey, and Johnny Giles. Now, Des Casey had been in touch with Bob Paisley and had been trying to get Bob Paisley in the frame.
Wow.
So somebody proposed Bob Paisley be added to the shortlist. It wasn't Des Casey, but because Des would have had the casting vote as chairman, but the suspicion was it was done in Des's request. So there was a 4-man shortlist at this point, and there were 18 votes. So Bob Paisley got 9 votes. Jack Charlton, Liam Toohey, and Johnny Giles got 3 votes each. And Des could only vote if there was a tie, but it was looking very like a tie. Well, so Liam Toohey got eliminated, and then it was Jack Charlton 5, Johnny Giles 4. So then Johnny Giles was eliminated, and then it was a straight runoff between Jack Charlton and Bob Paisley. Now, 9 people had voted for Bob Paisley. Even if the 4 people who were voting for Johnny Giles were going to row in behind Jack, it did look like the worst it could be was 9 all, and Bob Paisley would have been selected on Des Casey's casting vote. So, but what actually happened was someone switched their vote, and Jack won 10-8.
Whoa.
The suspicion was, or one of the journalists, I think it was Peter Byrne in the Irish Times, wrote that it was Colonel Tom Ryan, who was the army rep on the FAI, but I don't think it's known 100%. So Jack got it. It would have been, Jack Charlton was a football legend. He was part of the England team that won the World Cup in 1966. His brother Bobby was one of the greatest players of all time.
Mm.
And he was a very silky footballer, a great passer of the ball, a great shot. Jack was a no-nonsense centre half. He certainly didn't have the talent Bobby had, but he was a very good player. He only got into the England squad in his late 20s. I think he made his debut in about 1965. But he was on the team that won the World Cup. He was part of the great Leeds United team that dominated English football in the late 60s into the early 70s without winning as much as they should have. And the other thing about Jack was that he went into club management, mm-hmm. was very successful with Millwall, Sheffield Wednesday. He was a decent enough choice. But looking back in 1985, running into 1986, Bob Paisley had been much, much more successful as a manager and would appear to have been the better choice. Now, obviously, history says we got the
right man for the job.
We got the right man, of course, you know.
But it was... So, just a couple of things there as well, because I wanted to pick you up on something there too, and it was a big surprise to me was hearing that Johnny Giles' name was back in the hat for being manager again. The last kind of stints he'd had with Ireland, he'd kind of walked away the first time, and then he was back, and then he was kind of like, right, it's got to be me that kind of has control over this, otherwise it's not going to work. And then he kind of left again. So it seems strange to me that he would either A, put his name in the hat again, or his name would be put back in the hat again.
Yeah, so he put his name very much back in the hat. But I think because of the issues you mentioned, there would have been some opposition and some council members. So I think that's probably why he didn't get it. But he certainly, as a manager, brought so much. I mean, obviously as a player, one of our greatest ever players, but also as a manager, he brought so much. He transformed the national team. But I think probably he had also been very critical of FAI officials. So there were some of them that probably held a grudge. I mean, another person that missed out was Paddy Mulligan, because an FAI official accused him of throwing a bun at him on a away trip. Now, Paddy actually said it wasn't him. But,
it's like Pizzagate.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. And talk to us a little bit about as well the other name that you had there, which was Liam Toohey. Who was Liam Toohey, and why was his name so predominantly forward? Why did he get so close to being Ireland manager?
So Liam was another legendary player with both Shamrock Rovers and Ireland, obviously a great player, great winger. He did go on and manage he was managing at the time the underage teams, the youth team.
Ah, okay.
So that's how he came in the frame. And there is a story with Jack and himself as well, which I can go on and talk about. But so Liam would have been one of the legends of Irish football. So it made kind of sense to have him in the frame as well.
It seems extraordinary to me, because I didn't know this at all until you just mentioned that we came so close to getting Bob Paisley as an Ireland manager. Now, obviously, Jack turned out to be fantastic for us, but I mean, it's incredible that you know, Bob missed out, considering his pedigree with Liverpool. He'd won, you know, first division titles and turned them into European Cup champions. So it's kind of crazy that it did go to Jack. Am I kind of overstating that a little bit?
Yeah, no, I mean, if you go back to 1985-86, it would be considered a very strange appointment. But Bob Paisley is actually the most successful Liverpool manager of all time. That he took over in 1974, he won league titles, made them the dominant side in the late 70s, early 80s. They won three European Cups under him. So he had retired maybe, I think, around 83, because Joe Fagan had won the cup, the European Cup in 84. Mm. So Bob would have appeared to be the more obvious choice. Now, it's not to say Jack had been hugely successful player and had been very successful at the likes of Middlesbrough, at Sheffield Wednesday, etc. So it wasn't an outrageous call by any means, but I think the reaction when Jack got the job was a bit underwhelming. You know, there wasn't
a big fanfare about it.
There wasn't a big fanfare at all, you know. And actually, he couldn't be contacted when he got the job, so he the FBI didn't have his number. So
how did he know actually, he got the job?
Well, he knew he got the job because Jimmy Armfield, the legendary Leeds United manager, Jimmy knew where he could find Jack, which is probably fishing or something.
Yeah.
And he went and found Jack and told him he got the job. So
that is wonderful.
Different times.
Yeah. Absolutely different. No internet, no smartphones for you to contact everybody every day of the week. So Jack gets the job. First of all, what's the feeling about an Englishman coming to take the job as well? Was there feelings about that it should have been an Irish manager, considering that there was good Irish managers kind of in the frame for it as well?
There was. Now, I think Des Casey had said that going back into late 85, that maybe it was time to look across the water and get an English manager. You know, we had, obviously all our managers had been Irish. So it was time maybe to try a different tack. It certainly didn't go down well with some of the fans. I mean, there was a banner in Lansdowne Road in 1986, "Go home, Union Jack."
Oof.
So I don't know if they've tracked down the person with the banner. You can see them clearly in the photo. Remember at the time, there was also a banner at Old Trafford a little bit after that saying, was it three or four years of excuses to Ra Fergie, so for Alex Ferguson. So it's
too quick to judge. That's not like football fans at all.
Well, you know. So, but I think it's fair to say, actually, ironically, the only man, the main man to welcome Jack Charlton's appointment was Eamon Dunphy, who wrote pretty much straight away afterwards, "This is great. This is true leadership." Now, that might sound like a big surprise.
That all changed
within a week.
Yeah.
Yes. So a week later, when there was a press conference for Jack's appointment, So the journalists started to question and press Des Casey on Bob Paisley, and he didn't want to talk about it. So, and Jack kind of said, well, he doesn't have to talk about it. And Dunphy chimed in, no, that's a disgrace. Of course he should talk about it. And there was a little bit of a contretemps there, and I think Jack may have even invited Eamon to step outside and discuss it further. So,
a confrontation with Eamon Dunphy, well, that wouldn't be the first time, I would imagine, either.
Well, it was that was the beginning. That's where it all started.
Sure, for sure, so. Yeah. So Jack gets the job. Is it fair to say it's kind of met a bit lukewarm as well? And so how does he go about shaping this team then to turn into qualifying as well?
So it's the first couple of friendlies were a bit mad. I mean, we were beaten at home by Wales in his first match. I think we drew with Uruguay in Lansdowne Road. The first signs of anything was we were entered into a triangular tournament in Iceland at the summer of 1986 with the hosts Iceland and Czechoslovakia, who would have been a decent team at the time. Now, we beat Iceland, which was hardly a big surprise, but we actually beat Czechoslovakia 1-0 as well, which laid down a bit of a marker, and people were saying, hang on, that's a decent result. And the one thing Jack did do is he got the players together. They were away together for a period of time, and he had them playing the way he wanted them to play. But I think the real first sign was the first game in qualifying for Euro 88 was in September 86 away to Belgium. Now, we had got a horrible qualifying draw for Euro 88. There was only 8 teams were going to qualify, so only you had to top the group. In the group, we had the 1986 World Cup semi-finalists, Belgium. We had Bulgaria, who had reached the knockouts of the 86 World Cup. And we had Scotland, who had qualified, and they qualified. Okay, they didn't get to the knockouts, but they qualified. They were pretty much perennial qualifiers at that stage. They'd been in 86, they'd been in 82, they'd been in 78 and 74. All the World Cups, they hadn't actually reached the Euros. But so we were very much fourth best, expected to be fourth best in the group. Also in the group were Luxembourg, who were going to be the whipping boys of the group. So first up, we'd Belgium in Brussels, which was obviously a very, very difficult tie. And we fell behind early on. Frank Stapleton equalised, but we played really well. And there was a real sign, even though we were away from home, we had a real go at the Belgians. We were well organised. We caused them problems. We played good football. And we got a bit of luck because we were 2-1 down in the 89th minute. And I think it was Frank Stapleton was going through. And Jean-Marie Pfaff, the legendary Belgian goalie, had a bit of a rush of blood to the head. And he charged out and took down Frank Stapleton. And it was a penalty to Ireland, no doubt about it. The referee actually was Helmut Kohl, who became linesman. We'll go on and talk about him a couple of years later. But gave the penalty, no doubt about it. And Liam Brady calmly stroked home the penalty to earn a crucial point. And the confidence that result, that performance, that was a huge boost. And that really had people sitting up and taking notice that, hey, this is different. We can go away to the likes of a Belgium, who had lost in the semi-finals of the 86 World Cup a couple of months earlier to the eventual winners, Argentina, that we can go to Brussels and we can draw 2-2 with Belgium. So that was a real statement result, and that was definitely a sign that things were improving or things were changing.
Yeah, and that was good Belgian side as well. It's got Enzo Schifo there as well, which was a great player for Belgium, who lit up, as I recall, from my memory anyway, it did played very well in 1990 as well in Italy too. So yeah, so it was a good Belgian side that we went away to, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And if I recall correctly, he was the young player of the 86 World Cup. He was the young player of the tournament. Yeah. So yeah, definitely he was a fantastic player. And I have to look who actually played, but you had the likes of Cullimans, Van de Berg, etc. They had some really quality players, and they were one of the powerhouses of Europe at the time.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So we bring Scotland to Dublin. It's a 0-0 in Dublin. Is it fair to say then that the return fixture is the one that really lights the fire for qualification?
Yeah, so, well, we'll take them one by one, because a month after we went to Brussels, Scotland came to Dublin. Sold-out crowd, full house, brilliant atmosphere. We were the better team. We couldn't score. And Scotland kind of held on for a 0-0 draw. And that was, I suppose, if you were going to qualify, you really felt like you had to win. Mm. Okay, it was great to pick up the point in Brussels, but we really needed to win the home games, and it was 2 points for a win in those days, of course, so it felt like a point dropped. But as you say, so 86, I think we played a friendly away to Poland, which didn't really matter. Fast forward to February 1987 and the return game against Scotland at Hampden Park, and if Brussels was a wake-up call, this was certainly a huge night and a huge result. Because in a previous podcast, I talked about the win in Prague in 1967, which was a significant away victory. Mm. We hadn't beaten anyone of any significance away from home since then. Obviously, we'd wins in places like Malta and Iceland. But back in those days, they were routine. You'd be expected to beat the likes of them. So we hadn't beat anyone, let's say, away from home that you could say would regularly qualify for tournaments, until we beat Scotland 1-0 in Hampden. One goal, Mark Lawrence in the first 10 minutes, quickly taken free kick by John Aldridge. And Mark Lawrence, and what a player he was. Mm. And he went down and scored. We rode our luck a little bit, but we also had chances to make it 2 or 3-0. So one of the things Jack did that night, which certainly raised a few eyebrows, was we didn't have, Jim Biglin was injured. We didn't have our full backs available. And he was kind of expected to play Ashley Grimes at left full, but he actually went with Paul McGrath at right back and Ronnie Whelan at left back.
Oh.
Now, he had the likes of Mark Lawrence and Liam Brady in centre midfield, Mick McCarthy and Kevin Moran as centre backs. It was arguably one of the best teams we ever put out. Because unfortunately Mark Lawrence didn't make it to Euro 88. He had a lot of injuries after that. Mm. But what a majestic player he was, and he was in his prime at that stage. So Ronnie Whelan had the game of his life as well. He had a great game at left back, which was it was described by Noel Dunn in the Independent as his best ever game for Ireland at the time, you know. So we won the game 1-0. That was a huge result. Certainly made up for failing to win in Dublin. Mm. And that left us in good shape heading to Sofia in April 87.
Talk to us a little about the team. So you would have mentioned a couple of names there that obviously now we would have known as household names. But who's in the makeup of this Irish team?
Two of the players that Jack did bring in were Ray Houghton and John Aldridge. So they were brought in under the, we'll say, the granny rule. Ray Houghton had been at Fulham. John Aldridge had been at Oxford. Now, they did subsequently go to Liverpool.
Mm, yeah.
But they were two key players that certainly... But, I mean, the likes of Mark Lawrence and Liam Brady, Ronnie Whelan, Paul McGrath, Kevin Moran, Mick McCarthy, Frank Stapleton, Tony Galvin on the left, they'd all been already a mainstay of Irish sides before Jack.
Yeah.
So they didn't get their debut under Jack. You know, they'd all already been picked by Owen Hand or whoever before that. The bulk of the team was there. Certainly no doubt Ray Houghton and John Aldridge made a difference. I mean, John Aldridge took the quick free kick for Mark Lawrence's goal in Glasgow. Well, Jim Biglin was another player whose career was cruelly cut short by injury. Mm. What a cultured left back. What a player he was.
We go then away to to Sofia. Tell us about that match, and did it change perception about where we were going in this group?
Well, it was a huge blow in the group. We lost the game 2-1, but it was actually a superb performance. And it was the old, same old story with the hard luck. I mean, we went to goal down at half time. We played reasonably well, maybe a little bit unfortunate to be a goal down. It was Frank Stapleton equalised early in the second half. We were the better team. We were looking to win the game. And with about 9 minutes to go, Kevin Moran fouled a Bulgarian player outside the box. Now, Kevin has said to his dying day, he knew it was outside. And the referee, from a long way away, awarded a penalty. And that was the winning goal. Tanev got his converted the penalty, got his second goal of the game to beat us. Even the Bulgarian manager said they were fortunate to win afterwards. Should have at least got a draw.
Was there a feeling of kind of here we go again? We're getting mugged.
Yeah, I think there was. It was. I mean, it. I suppose it did set up the Belgium home game at the end of the month. So at that, we were definitely in must-win territory at that stage. I mean, Belgium actually were probably the ones that looked in good control of the group at this stage. But they came to Dublin. Again, it was a sellout crowd. In fact, it's probably one... I got a bit of an eye-opener because my dad... I was in college in Cork at the time, and my dad in Dublin off the train, and Limerick were playing midweek away to St. Pat's. And we had a bit of time. He said, we'll go into the FAI and get our tickets for the Belgium game. This might have been a week or two. I'll have to look at the date of the fixture, but I think it was a week or two before the game. And went into Merrion Square and said, get two tickets, please. And said, sorry, it's sold out. I said, don't be stupid. It couldn't be sold out.
we don't sell out games.
No, we had sold out the Scotland game, but it was kind of at a push. And I think he asked for, I think it was Tony Butler was the CEO. And I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but in those days, I suppose it was a lot. And Tony came down and said, well, he says, no problem. We'll sort you out for two tickets and you can pay there. And he said, you better buy your Brazil tickets now as well, which we did. But I mean, I took it because my dad had left block booking slide. We had block bookings that were let go and were kind of going on match by match at that stage. And I took it as a wake-up call, which was a good thing to always make sure I had my ticket lined up and not wait till the last week or two or so before the game. So, but that Belgium game was totally sold out. There was huge interest, huge demand. And unfortunately, the same old story at home in front of goal, we couldn't score. Mm. So the Belgian team came for a point. They defended well. We probably didn't do enough to win the game. We had chances, but didn't do enough to deserve a win. Geethy set up his side very well. And that left them two or three points ahead of us from the same number of games, from what I can remember now. And they were in control of the group.
So the Belgians knew the importance of this fixture by the sounds of it. So their setup, kind of what you're saying is, they kind of went to Dublin not to lose. So whatever about winning the game or doing this. So they were just there to, right, whatever we do, do not come away from Dublin with 0 points.
I'm trying to remember, but I think they'd already beaten Scotland at home. They'd beaten, I can't remember when they'd beaten Bulgaria. I think they'd beaten Bulgaria at this stage as well, or maybe it was after that. But they were certainly well in control of the group at that stage. They looked like and they would have been favourites before the group started as well. Mm. So they still had to go to Sofia in September and they had to go to Hamden in October. But they were in good shape at that stage. And the point was, they were certainly by far the happier with the point. It certainly felt like coming out of Lansdowne Road that day that our qualification was more or less over.
Yeah. I suppose that if we take a bit of a Euro 88 qualifying break and talk about our our friendly against Brazil that happened in between then. Talk to us a little bit about this kind of game. Who's this Brazilian side, and are these the kind of, is this the Brazilian side that kind of we all kind of would have all the household names, or is this a kind of what kind of Brazil are we looking at?
So I mean the Brazil, there's always a magic around Brazil. Okay, there is they had been at that stage, they hadn't won the World Cup since 1970. So, but in 1982, they'd been in many ways the team of the tournament. They'd if they could defend, they probably would have won the World Cup. So there were still some of the stars of 82 left. In 86, again, they were beaten, I think, on penalties by a brilliant French team in an epic quarter final. So they were still Brazil. They were a magical name. This was their... So they had come to Dublin for an exhibition against an All-Ireland team in 1973. We had gone to Brazil a couple of times at that stage.
That's right, yeah.
But coming to Dublin, first international in Dublin against them, they should have been a much bigger draw than they were. And I don't know why. It's a mystery to me.
Yeah.
We sold out the Belgium game a few weeks earlier. Tickets had been very difficult to get. And I think we had something like 17,000. Mm. What I can remember, it was a lovely day when we played Brazil in May 1987.
Yeah, so I've got the attendance here in front of me. So 49,000 sellout for Belgium, and only, 18,000 for Brazil. I mean, Brazil, pretty much in any decade, should always be a nice marquee kind of event to go and see, shouldn't it?
It should have been. Now, I mean, I should point out Argentina were the world champions, and so they probably would have been a bigger name. So they'd come to Dublin in 70, because they'd been world champions in 78 as well. So they came to Dublin in 79 and 80 as world champions as well. So, but Brazil, it was still Brazil. I mean, as I said, we bought our tickets the day we were buying the Belgium tickets as well. And I mean, it was a case, yeah, it's Brazil. That's going to sell out as well. It's a good job we're buying them. No, we would have been very, very laid back in those days about buying tickets, because I mean, the Scotland game, I think, might have sold out a day or two before the game, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that hard to get a ticket, you know.
Yeah.
So certainly were surprised by the low attendance. And then what a game. We actually, the losers were the 30,000 who didn't go.
Yeah.
Because we beat Brazil, I mean, a fantastic goal by Liam Brady, and we beat Brazil 1-0.
Extraordinary. I mean, it's funny. Like, I know you can argue the kind of the level that Brazil were probably at the time, but even so, they would have still had great players. They would have still had very, very good players on their national side. And for us to kind of win 1-0 was just, that's an incredible result. To do that,
yeah. I mean, there's never a bad Brazilian team, you know. It's well, I mean, they can well, win the world.
Lost seven, yeah. Against Germany.
That was an incredible result. But I mean, remember, that was in the semi-finals of a World Cup that many people expected them to win. You know, they got Carlo Ancelotti now as new manager. They could well win the World Cup next year. You know, it was Brazil. If you pull on that yellow shirt, you have to be a quality player.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Is our advantage then, we draw with Belgium, it seems to kind of have sucked the life a little bit out of our qualification group. Is it perhaps a good thing then that our next two matches are Luxembourg, and it helps us to build up some points essentially and make a charge?
Yeah, I mean, it probably felt like we were out of contention and Luxembourg, we would always been expected to beat Luxembourg. And we went there in at the end of the 86-87 English season and beat them comfortably enough in Luxembourg. And they came to Dublin in September 87, very much as whipping boys. And it didn't go as planned. We actually went a goal down after about half an hour. And although we equalised fairly quickly, it was getting a bit nervous well into the second half. And I think Paul McGrath headed the winner with about 15 minutes to go. So we got the win, but it was a bit nervous. Wasn't looking too good. And even at that stage, I think we would have been on 9 points, I think. We'd only one game left. There were a lot of other games left in the group. Mm. And it was still advantage Belgium. And the table didn't look that healthy. But then a few results, we needed results to go our way. And we go on and talk about the last crucial game. But a few other results did go our way as well. At the end of September, Bulgaria beat Belgium 2-0, which turned the group a little bit on its head and put Bulgaria right in contention. And that meant Bulgaria were coming to Dublin for our last game in October, and Belgium were going to Glasgow to play Scotland. Scotland were pretty much already out. And we were, I suppose, pretty much out at that stage as well. Unless to have any chance at all, we needed to beat Bulgaria. And we also needed Scotland to beat Belgium. Because I think people forget that if Scotland hadn't beaten Belgium that night, if Belgium would probably have gone on and won the group. They still had to play Luxembourg, but they obviously disposed of them, no problem. So the results that night in October 87, when we beat Bulgaria, it was actually an afternoon game because there was no lights. But later that night, Scotland beat Belgium 2-0 as well. We beat Bulgaria 2-0. It was an excellent performance. We were really good. We played really well. And it certainly gave a lot of hope for the future. We bossed the game, comfortably beat Bulgaria, but unfortunately, all you had, Bulgaria still, because of the result in Glasgow, they only needed a draw at home to Scotland the following month to qualify, and that was seen as a formality. So, impressive performance, impressive win, definitely hope going forward for the World Cup, but I don't think anybody expected Scotland to win in Bulgaria.
It's kind of one of those things that kind of crops up in the Jack Charlton area as well, isn't it? The kindness of strangers type of thing, results elsewhere, kind of give us a kick and kind of push us into the frame when we thought we were probably not there. But that game for Scotland in Bulgaria, is that essentially the one that gets us over the line?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very simple. I mean, we had finished our campaign on 11 points. Bulgaria were on 10 points. They had one game left, which was at home to Scotland. A draw would put them through on goal difference. A win would put them through, obviously, by winning the group. Scotland were already out of contention. They had nothing to play for. Belgium were out as well. So it all boiled down to... And the other thing was, Scotland in November 87 had a lot of withdrawals. I mean, Graham Souness was the Rangers manager, and Rangers were incredibly successful at the time and had a lot of big games in Europe, etc. And I think he withdrew all the Rangers players from the Scottish squad, which was a number of the players with these injuries or whatever, because it was a nothing game. It didn't matter. And because the better Scotland players were withdrawn, they went to some guy called Gary McCoy of Hearts, who was pretty much a nobody at the time.
And he turned out to be a somebody for us, because what did he do?
Absolutely. Now, the game was also carried live on RTE. And I will go back to 1981, November 81, because Owen Hand had been incredibly unlucky. It's more than that. And we know all the stuff he said to the referee in Brussels and everything.
From our last podcast.
Even allowing for that, own hand needed France and the Netherlands to draw in Paris, and we were in a World Cup. Now, that was not unrealistic. The Dutch needed to win to qualify. The French needed to win to qualify. A draw would have put us through. We had, certainly, we felt there's a really good chance that could happen. And I mean, I remember watching that game on TV and thinking, yeah, this could be a draw. No, France won. Okay, it was. But I don't think any Irish fan expected Scotland to go to Sofia and win. They had no right to win the game. They were totally. Bulgaria bossed the game for 87 minutes. They just couldn't put the ball in the net. And it looked like it was going to peter out at 0-0. I can't remember Scotland even having a chance. And in the 87th minute, ball is played to Gary McCoy, and he sticks one in from about, I remember it, about 20 yards. I'd have to watch it back. But an incredible goal out of the blue. And I'd actually just started work. I'd started work a few weeks before that. And it was on a Wednesday afternoon. So obviously, I would have been very nervous about going out. There was no internet to follow it online at that stage. And a couple of colleagues who were maybe a year or two older, who'd been in the company for maybe 2 years and 1 year longer than me, they said, we're going to sneak out and watch the second half. Do you want to come along? So one of the guys, he lived just up the road from the office at the time. I was working in Galway. And so we went to his house for the start of the second half, and went in to find it was still 0-0. And we just couldn't believe it when Gary McCoy scored. We just went nuts. And the celebrations were incredible. Of course, we had to go straight back to work. Because it was still during the working day. Oh, the middle of the day, yeah.
That's class. So you mitched off work to watch a legendary piece of Irish history given to us from Scotland.
Yeah, absolutely. Live on RTE, and thanks to Gary McCoy. And I don't think anyone... And I also remember saying to my colleagues, and that's my summer holiday sorted for next year. I'm off to Germany
for 2 weeks.
And I was the only one that of the group that went up. Four of us went up to watch the match. I think one or two of them were talking about going as well, but I was the only one that went in the end.
Oh yeah, and give us a sense of what the country was like after this, because we've talked about so long. On this podcast as well, gone down through the years, the hard luck stories or the teams that just weren't good enough or blown in the last couple of games, etc., etc. And for somebody like yourself, who'd been to loads of Ireland games, somebody like your father, who had been to an inordinate amount of games as well, what was it like to kind of be in that moment and all of a sudden realize that you're going to, like, the hopes and dreams that you always had, you're going to see it. We're going to a major championship.
I mean, I will go back 2 years before that. So that was November 1987. In November 1985, the late Jimmy McGee said after the Danish defeat, he says, and Jimmy would have been well into his 50s at that stage, he says, sadly, he says, Ireland are never going to play in a major finals in my lifetime. I was 19 when Jimmy said that, and I agreed with him. So within 2 years, we were wrong. And it was so special because it was so unexpected the way it happened. And it really meant a lot. Now, you talk about the country, and we can go on and talk about Italia 90 and what happened during Euro 88. But it wasn't, so it was a huge deal for the football people of Ireland at that stage to qualify for a major tournament. But it hadn't caught the imagination of the whole country the way that team did go on to do, if I'm explaining this properly.
Yeah, I mean, so Italia 90 captured everybody. Everybody was in on Italia 90.
Yeah.
But Euro 88, people were like, oh, we're going to a European championship. Okay, and perhaps the feeling maybe that, okay, great, we'll go over there and sure, we'll play a couple of games. We don't really expect anything to happen, but we're there.
Yeah, we're there. And even, let's say, for the people who wouldn't normally pay attention to Irish football, they still didn't really pay attention. They might have said, oh, great, they've qualified, or something like that. Mm. Maybe if you like it today, I remember the women's hockey team a few years ago got to a final of it. Right, yeah, and I mean, suddenly everyone became aware of the hockey team, but on their path to the final, I suppose it was only the hockey aficionados that were aware of that. So, I mean, it was a big deal to qualify. There were great celebrations, but it was more the football people. The people that went to Germany were the people who would be normally, let's say, either going to the League of Ireland or maybe going to watch Liverpool or Man United or maybe volunteering, working at their local club, even at junior level or something like that. I very much make the distinction because Euro 88 was for the football people of Ireland and Italian 90 and then on was for the whole country, everybody. And it was a bit of a difference. And even in the build-up to Euro 88, I mean, we didn't play in front of sellout crowds or anything like that. It was just still fairly low-key.
Talk to us a bit about the when the group happened as well, because it's interesting. What was the reaction when we got, of all teams we could have got, we got England? You know, I mean, it must have been extraordinary that we go to major championships, and the one time we get to a major championships, we have to play the team that we always love to beat and hate to lose to.
Yeah, and then to get them as the first game as well. So I'll be honest, I didn't want them. I was hoping to avoid them. And I do remember the BBC or the ITV coverage, and they were talking about that Euros and said basically, it's Jimmy Hill that said, it would have been BBC, that there were seven very strong teams in the Euros, and there was the Republic of Ireland. And it was great for England to get us in the group because it meant that it was 2 from 3 to qualify for the semi-finals instead of 2 from 4 as it would have been in the other group. So,
so what was the feeling? That was it dread that we'd gotten England?
Yeah, I think there was a concern that we were okay. It's fantastic to be there. It's great to be in the Euros. But you don't want to go first and get smashed. You mean, if we went there and we got smashed by Italy, Germany and Spain, you'd have said, well,
yeah,
Italy, Germany and Spain, top teams, and it's no disgrace. It's great to be there. Feeling was, you're going there, if you get smashed by England in the first game, it's a bit different. And it would be embarrassing and a bit humiliating, etc.
Yeah, talk to us a bit about the groups as well, because there's only 8 teams in the entire tournament, which, by modern standards, now sounds ludicrous. So it's a really kind of very small, condensed version of what we know now, isn't it?
Yeah. So I mean, the Euros had been only 4 teams up to 1976, and in 1980 it went to 8. And for 84 as well. So it was the cream of Europe. I mean, it was 2 groups of 4. The top 2 go into the semi-finals. And so it was the creme de la creme of European football. I mean, in the other group, you had Germany, the host, always a powerhouse of football. Mm-hmm. They were to go on and win the World Cup 2 years later. Italy, again, one of the massive names in world football. Spain. And Denmark, and the Danish team had done so well in the 1986 World Cup. They had qualified comfortably for Euro 88. I mean, they were potentially, obviously they went down and won the Euros in 92. Mm. But it actually would have been less of a shock had they won Euro 88 instead of Euro 92, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But so that was the other group. That was Group A. We were in Group B, so we had the Dutch. obviously they'd been so unlucky in the two World Cup finals in the 70s. Mm. And very talented team like Hullet, Van Basten, etc. The Soviet Union, always a bit of a dark horse, a bit of an unknown quantity, but real quality players. And you had the likes of, I think Igor Belanov was European Footballer of the Year a year or two earlier. I think he was 86, European Footballer of the Year. They had a lovely, they had Protasov, Oleg Protasov up front, a deadly striker. Dasyev in goal, probably one of the best keepers in the world at the time. And some really talented players on that Soviet side. And then you had England, who, well, were always going into those tournaments, one of the favourites, expecting to win, feeling they were cheated out of the 86 World Cup when Diego Maradona headed the ball over Peter Shilton. And,
even now, you're not going to give it to them, are you? Even now. essentially this is our group of death, really, isn't it? We're not really expected to do much here.
No, I mean, the group of death was probably the other one, because whichever group
for us it was our group of death, though, wasn't it? Players.
I think whatever happened, it didn't make a huge difference. We were going to have three really tough games, when we would have been very much second favourites. I think there's no doubt about that. And in my case, there was all sorts of reasons to want to avoid England, because there was a lot of hooliganism and everything at that stage as well. So it would have made life a lot simpler if we were off in some other part of Germany when England were playing elsewhere, you know. So but we were drawn together, and up first, June 12th, 1988, Neckar Stadium in Stuttgart, and England, first game in the major finals.
Were you at Stuttgart?
Oh, I was, absolutely.
I asked that knowing the answer before I asked it. What was it like in the run-up to that? So we hear a lot and we see a lot now, you know, when Ireland get to major championships, that is. You know, the Irish fans, how great they are and how everybody loves them. And it's always almost like a festival of football anytime we're in the tournament. What was it like back then? It's the 80s in Germany. This is am I right in saying this is a Germany that's still kind of divided at the time? Ish as well, so yep. So it's a very different Germany, and so I mean it's a different kind of world that you kind of to step into as well. So what was it like in the build up to that, being in Germany, staying in Germany, and being part of this?
So I mean, it was actually, of course, correctly to say West Germany.
Yeah,
you're correct. It was still the Berlin Wall didn't, and in fact, it would have been unthinkable at that stage for the Berlin Wall to come down. That was another year and a half away. It was West Germany. The country was a lot richer than Ireland, I have to say that. I mean, I had started work. I'd finished college in 87. I'd started work, so I was earning money. So it came at the perfect time for me. I had no ties. I still had to borrow money to go. If I remember correctly, I think I had to borrow £500, and the whole trip cost me £1,100. And it's been holidays at work, and that was in a tent. So holidays at work were pretty tight. So I did decide to go for the full tournament, which was 2 weeks. Ever the optimist. Yeah, we're
going to win it all.
So, stay for it all. And of course, it was very easy to get tickets in those days as well. You just wrote off to the FBI and you got... There was nobody, no Irish fan that wanted a ticket for any of the games of the tournament had a problem getting a ticket. So we got whatever tickets we wanted. Wow. Everyone just wrote off to the FBI and you got a ticket. Or you got your tickets. And but I had to work right up to Friday, June 10th. So I actually had to fly to Paris on early Saturday morning to meet the car in Paris on Saturday lunchtime that was driving with the tent to Stuttgart. And I think I can probably tell the story at this stage. It's a long, long time ago, but a friend of mine, he was more of a friend of one of my housemates. He had an exam on the Thursday, which would have been June 9th in college, and they had a free day on Wednesday the 8th, and the car was leaving on Thursday the 9th. So he went to UCC and said his sister was getting married, total made-up story. Is there any way that they could move the exam from Thursday the 9th to Wednesday the 8th? So he waited a couple of days and they came back and said, look, we're really sorry, we can't arrange with the schedule for Wednesday the 8th, but we wouldn't want you to miss the wedding, so we're moving the exam to Friday the 10th.
Yeah.
That made it worse because he lost another 24 hours. He could probably have left persuaded or got to the boat or found a way. So that totally scuppered him. So he ended up on my flight in our car meeting his mates in Stuttgart. But it was very much a case of back there, I mean, the song Jocks Are Goes to Stuttgart, Christy Moore summed it up.
Yeah, yeah.
It was planes, trains, automobiles. I mean, flights were expensive in those days. Even the flight to Paris for me was a big chunk of the cost. And our car broke down as well. So we didn't get to Stuttgart till very late on the Saturday night. I think it was nearly midnight.
I'm interested.
It was a Saturday night.
I'm interested here as well about this tent. There is no hotels, no B&Bs. Did you just park up and pitch a tent?
Oh, no, we didn't park up. So there were campsites. So, I mean, this was, it was more of a cost thing than any. There were hotels and there were B&Bs, but the relative cost of those would possibly have made it unaffordable.
Yeah, yeah.
So we very much, I mean, I was working, I was earning money, and I had a good job. I mean, I had a degree in computer science, so I was earning very good money, relatively speaking, at the time. But it was still a huge cost. So, I mean, the tent was the way to do it. So we had a two-man tent. We had a car. We were sharing the costs. And so we were booked into a campsite. And I can still remember the name, but it was called Bad Cannstatt, Cannstatt. And actually, it's still there because, it was there last Euros because Scottish fans that I know stayed in it when Scotland were playing in Stuttgart for Euro 2024. So the campsite is still there. So
is there a picture on the wall of Gary Spain and under it says "Do not admit"?
not in those days. So we arrived late on Saturday night and it was absolutely bucketing out of the heavens. I mean there was no way we could have pitched a tent. So we ended up sleeping in the car the night before the game. But luckily the campsite had showers, you know. Well, I mean the campsites in Germany are well organized. Oh, yeah, so they all have showers and everything. It would have been a very, very modest fee in those days to pitch your tent, and you get to use the showers and everything then. So we were able to have showers and everything the following morning, pitch the tent the following morning. But we did Euro 88 in the tent.
That's brilliant. So you get to Euro 88 by hook or by crook, planes, trains, and automobiles. Was there any expectation going into the England game that we could pull off what we did?
Honestly, no. I don't. I maybe some people will say, with hindsight, I don't think any of the Irish fans expected us to win the game. We were hoping it wouldn't be embarrassing. Maybe if you thought if on a really good day we could keep it tight and maybe nick a draw or something like that. But we were expected to lose. You know, it was first time up, huge occasion. Now, looking back again with hindsight, Liverpool had done really well. They'd won the league, probably should have won the double, lost the cup final to Wimbledon. We had a few of that Liverpool team. So we had Houghton, we had Aldridge, we had Whelan. Celtic won the double in Scotland. We had Paddy Bonner, Mick McCarthy, Chris Morris of the Celtic team. So we had players who were, let's say,
playing at the top.
Quality, playing it right at the top and winning trophies. So maybe we were a bit underestimating ourselves, but certainly the fans I knew in those days, we didn't expect much. And I mean, it was a crack English team. I mean, Gary Lineker had got the golden boot in the 86 World Cup. He was expected to tear us to bits. He had Peter Shilton in goal, Steve McMahon, etc. Mark Rice, I think, played that day as well. They'd
Kenny Sampson.
They'd a really, yeah, Kenny Sampson. But yeah, absolutely, he did actually, because he was involved in the goal. So yeah, Peter Beardsley came on, if I remember right. I know Mark Hatley came on as well, and but it was a really, really fancied English side, so they would have been hot favourites to win the game.
And a true Irish style at a major tournament, we score early and then somehow have to cling on for 85 or so minutes to see it out. I watched back highlights and all that kind of stuff of that specific match, and to say that it was backs against the wall after that Houghton goal would probably be an underestimation. We really were just under the cosh for 85 minutes, weren't we?
I don't know about the 85 minutes, but we were, particularly in the second half, we were under the cosh with all hands to the pump for a lot of the game. I mean, instead, we got the early goal. Place went nuts. I was behind the goal. I mean, the Irish fans were pretty much behind the goal or in the arc around behind the goal where Ray Houghton scored. And it just went absolutely nuts. I remember trying to find my camera to get a photograph of the scoreboard and being told, relax, you've another 85 minutes to take.
I want to get it now in case it all changes.
Well, that was my thinking. But, I mean, we just went nuts. And then, but I mean, I would point out Ronnie Whelan hit the bar with about half an hour to go. And if that had gone in, you know, it might have been a bit more comfortable. But certainly it felt like it was Gary Lineker against Paddy Bonner for the last half an hour. And somehow, I mean, Paddy obviously had the game of his life. And, I know another thing that kind of haunted me, and I think appreciate Mark Hatley. I don't think he was born in the West Country, but he was a man associated very much with the West Country in England, because a big bumbling West Country man by the name of John Attio of Bristol City had broken Irish hearts in 1957 gasp goal. And I saw Mark Hatley rise with a couple of minutes to go, and I thought back to John Attio and thinking, oh no, not again. Not again. And thankfully, it didn't go in, and it stayed out. And we
was it one of those
we hung on to win.
Yeah, was it one of those kind of like you get into the last 5 minutes and all you're doing is just looking at the scoreboard. You're looking at the clocks. The clock's just not going quick enough. I don't know where these seconds seem to be going 3 seconds at a time.
Yeah, the trucks were going backwards, if I remember. Certainly they were stopped. But it was just, I thought the game was never going to end, you know. I mean, it felt more like there were 85 or 84 hours after Ray Houghton got that goal rather than 84 minutes. It seemed to go on forever. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would imagine. So, final whistle, I mean, it must have been extraordinary. What were you doing? Were you pinching yourselves? Did you understand what was after happening?
Well, we just went nuts. I mean, the celebrations, we didn't want to leave. We were there for certainly quite a long time after the final whistle. I don't think anyone wanted to leave the stadium, just singing, cheering, just in absolute awe, astonishment, just pure delight. I mean, it's still, for me, the greatest moment following the Republic of Ireland. I don't think we can top that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I was in the Giant Stadium for Italy. I was in Genoa. But I don't think anything's going to top beating England in our first game in a major tournament.
Yeah.
Given the whole history of who it was, and because it was our first game, and we had tried so long and so hard. I mean, I was only, 21 when we beat England. But I mean, it's people like Jimmy McGee, who had been 30, 40 years before, like my dad. I mean, we'd been waiting for, thought we'd never qualify. We came so close so many times. And even if you go back to the 1930s, which was before they were born, we came very close then as well. So there have been so many hard luck stories. And to get to a tournament, to play England up first, the old enemy, and then to beat them, it was just incredible. You couldn't have scripted it any better.
Yeah. It's funny how the, I suppose, the weight of history makes a moment far more special than perhaps moments that come afterwards that might be more popular or you know, that people remember better or something like that. It's that moment right there, isn't it? That one, in that one place, because there is so much the weight of history upon it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I also say as well, it was one really for the football people of Ireland. It was the people who had either lined the pitches in junior football, had followed the League of Ireland. The fans who had gone to follow the national team were the ones in Germany. There weren't any new fans. By the time we got to Italy, there were people going to the first football match of their lives. Though that didn't happen in Germany. The people that were in Stuttgart that day were the football people, and there were so many people from all corners. Now, there was probably a big Dublin bias because football was much stronger in Dublin than it was elsewhere in the country. But also from places like Westport, a real football town, Tullamore, Kerry, huge pockets of football in some of these places, even back in the 80s, which you wouldn't really have expected. So it was one. Sligo, obviously, as well. It was one for the real football people of the country.
Yeah, a nod from the soccer gods to say sorry about all the 80-odd years before that, perhaps. But we still have the rest of a group to play as well. And we played the Soviet Union in the next game. And is it fair to say unlucky that we didn't come away with a victory there?
I think absolutely. Because, I mean, whatever about the England game, the performance against the Soviets was out of this world. That was our best performance. Arguably, some say our greatest ever performance. And we played them off the park. We were goal up, Roddy Whelan with a shinner or a spectacular volley.
Absolutely spectacular volley, sir.
A brilliant goal, an absolutely brilliant goal. He gets slagged about it being a shinner, but it was a brilliant goal. And we should have had a penalty. Dasayev took out Tony Galvin. And with 15 minutes to go against the run of play, Oleg Protasov, super striker, great finisher, nicked an equaliser that they barely deserved. And instead of being sitting on top of the group on 4 points, we were stuck on 3, level with the Soviets. And earlier that day, the Dutch had beaten England with a Marco van Basten hat-trick. They had beaten England 3-1, which really, at that stage, it looked like it was setting the group up between ourselves and the Dutch for a semi-final spot.
Yeah, and we had to play the Dutch then in that final game. And you were there in Gelsenkirchen. What was that game like? Because I'll let you tell it.
Okay. So I suppose for the game in Hanover against the Soviets, we made up the bulk of the crowd. I mean, it was by no means full. There were a load of empty seats. Those games didn't sell out. As I said, tickets were quite easy. The England game was by no means a sellout. England had big support. We had big support. A lot of German neutrals, but lots of empty seats as well. Get to Gelsenkirchen for the third game. If you know your German geography, Gelsenkirchen is less than an hour from the Dutch border. And I'd said tickets were very easy and any Irish fan could have got tickets. One of my mates, Jimmy, had actually booked an extra ticket. They were only a few quid each. And I think he had it for somebody who was maybe hoping to go and didn't make it. The Dutch came over in their droves. There must have been over 40,000 Dutch fans in Gelsenkirchen that day. And we actually gave him a really hard time because he ended up by accident touting the ticket. He went out to sell the ticket and he was surrounded by about 100 Dutch fans. And I think the ticket was, if I remember, about 15 or 20 Deutschmarks at the time. And a Dutch fan put 50 Deutschmarks note in his hand and took the ticket.
Whoa.
And he was gone before Jimmy could even say it. And we gave him an awful time, saying, "Oh, you're a ticket tout and everything." And it's, but I mean, the Dutch, there were thousands of Dutch locked out that day. There were thousands of them there without tickets. But the Irish, I mean, we had about maybe 13, 14, 15,000 fans. And we were kind of all separated as well. We were up in, in fact, we were separated. There were four of us at that stage, and we were separated as well. We were up in a corner, in a pocket of Irish fans on the top. If you're looking at the stand, top left-hand corner, and we were surrounded by Dutch. And incredible atmosphere. We played well, but it was a majestic Dutch side. Paul McGrath had a header, hit the post, ran along the line, didn't cross the line. And but again, no more than the England game, as the game wore on, we had been hanging on a bit. But as Jack said, he thought Rinus Michels, the Dutch manager, had lost it a little bit because he took off. I can't remember actually who took off. He took off a midfield player who'd been causing us a lot of problems. I'd have to check who he took off, and brought on an extra striker and made them a little bit unbalanced. And Jack thought we'd kind of just weathered the storm. We got over the hump, but with 8 minutes to go, the referee from Brussels was a man called Helmut Kohl, who shared a name with the German Chancellor, an Austrian, if I remember correctly. And he put up his offside flag because Wim Kieft was coming out from an offside position. And he took it down, and Wim Kieft headed the ball, and not just the unlucky with the offside flag, but it spun. And sorry, the offside flag wasn't against Wim Kieft, it was against a different Dutch player coming out. But Wim Kieft got his head to the ball, and it spun, and it just deceived Paddy Bonner and spun into the net. And the Dutch, we needed a draw for the semi-finals, and the Dutch, they got the win they needed. And that was the end of our Euro 88 adventure.
The curse of Belgium comes back to haunt us again. But it must have been this, and you kind of mentioned it before the start of the tournament, this wild, crazy adventure that you perhaps never thought that in your lifetime you would be going on. So, and to go through it and to live it and to see, I suppose, to be proud of an Irish football team again on a major stage.
Absolutely. And pride is the word, definitely. I mean, there was definitely disappointment at the final whistle, but the overwhelming emotion was pride. It was so proud of the whole tournament, everything that had gone on. And you mentioned the Irish fans, and I should go back to that because this is where the legend of the Irish fans really started, because we had gone and arrived in Stuttgart, and I think we got on Sunday morning or even in the campsite on Saturday night when we arrived, we paid our fees. We got a very frosty reception from the Germans. We weren't welcome. On Sunday morning, they didn't want us there. And they kind of had they didn't understand or anything, and there were English guys in the campsite wearing T-shirts with two World Wars, one World Cup, England invasion of Germany 40 years on, and stuff like that. And as far as the Germans were concerned, it was England A against England B.
Oh.
And then we beat them, and it's all over German television. And suddenly everything is different, because in Stuttgart that night, there was little old ladies stopping and shaking her hands and saying, "Thank you. Thank you so, so much."
Now you're the heroes.
It was, and that's, it been the whole, the Irish fans then, I mean, everybody, there was a, there was an image then of the fans behaving themselves, having a good time, being so different from the hooligans, because there were Dutch hooligans at that time as well. And I do tell the story, it could have been very, very different if Wim Kieft hadn't scored that goal. We were getting very, very nervous up in that corner, and the Dutch fans were pretty menacing, and suddenly they score, they win, they're happy. But it could have ended differently that day in Gelsenkirchen.
Wow.
But anyway, hooliganism was much more common on the continent in those days. And but then nobody wanted to do anything to tarnish the reputation, and fans were very much keeping an eye out for one another. If somebody was drunk, they were just taking care of them, etc. If anyone was going to step out of line, maybe one of the older fans would have had a word, etc. And it's really that tournament that the legend and the good behaviour of the Irish fans, I think it really... Now, not that there was ever really trouble before that, but certainly that's when it really kicked off, I think, from Euro 88.
But it's a culture, though, isn't it? I mean, it's a culture within, I think, Irish fans that grew from there, in terms of, you know, you're there to enjoy the football, you're there to enjoy the country that you're in, and to be part of their welcome, in that environment, in that tournament, and that's what you take on board. That's the fun. That's the enjoyment. You might not speak the language, but you get on with each other as Irish fans often seem to do over a pint, or, you know, that kind of the pidgin English, or, you know, something like that, where you try and make your way around and kind of be part of the tournament without being the bad boys of the tournament like other countries have so often been.
Yeah, we were never looking for a fight or anything like that. But even things like, I remember at the time, the Irish 5p coin was the same size as the one Deutschmark coin. And I think it was worth maybe about a fifth or a sixth of a Deutschmark. So for people to ring home, there were a lot of people that brought 5p coins to Germany. And I think famously the German ambassador had lumped a load of 5p coins on someone's desk in Dublin and saying, your country are a disgrace. So what actually, this was before the tournament. Now, this has nothing to do with the fans. So what actually happened then was people started saying, no 5p's. You only use Deutschmarks in the phone. You know, rather than damage the reputation. So the word was going around. So people that brought the 5p coins basically brought them home. And they paid the full back to pay for the calls home, which would have been very expensive. I mean, you're going to a payphone in those days, you're making a call back to Limerick or Dublin, it would have been very expensive. It would have been a lot cheaper to use your 5p coins, but nobody wanted to do anything to tarnish the reputation. And the word was out on that even in Germany in Euro 88.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, that's good too. So the tournament ends, and yet again, ironically, as seemed to have crops up so much in Irish footballing history, the Netherlands beats us, knocks us out, but then they go on to win the tournament, which seems to happen to us quite a lot. We often get beaten by, you know, the team that ends up in the semi-final or the team that ends up in the final.
It's always a case of what might have been, you know. I mean, we stayed on, so I stayed for the following week. I got to see, and we had tickets for both semi-finals and the final.
Oh, brilliant.
So I got to see the Netherlands beat West Germany in Hamburg, which was an iconic day in Dutch football because they hadn't won in Germany for about 30 years, and having lost the 74 World Cup, to actually go to Hamburg to come from a goal down and beat the Germans, that was a really special night. It could have been us. Why couldn't we have beaten the Germans? And then we'd have had the Soviets in the final, the team we outplayed in Hanover. Who knows? Who knows?
Absolutely,
who knows?
Yeah. But it's quite extraordinary, and I suppose I can't leave it there without asking about the Dutch side that you went to see as well, filled with just these wildly iconic names, and particularly Marco van Basten, who it was just an absolutely incredible striker, and in that tournament he was just on a level that was just incredible.
Yeah, the goal he scored. I mean, I was actually behind the goal in Munich that he scored that goal. Probably the greatest goal I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible goal. I mean, they'd Ruud Gullit on that team. They had such a fantastic, talented Dutch side. Probably their greatest ever. Well, I have to say the 74 team maybe didn't get it over the line. But this team in 88 did get it over the line. And you have to say incredible winners and what a tournament it was for the Dutch. But what a team. And again, Munich, the tens of thousands of Dutch fans locked out of the game in Munich. They were offering silly money for the tickets, but there was no way it was party. You know, it would tickets anyway. But we just said, sorry, we just want to see the game. We're not going to going to miss it.
So what's the reaction then back home? Is this where, as you say, is this where the the rest of the nation begins to buy into to Irish football? Or is it only when we kind of roll in and qualify for Italian 90 that it really begins to take over? What was the reaction back home?
Well, I mean, of course, I wasn't home and I didn't get home.
Afterwards.
But I, from calling home, certainly, it did capture the country. So it didn't so much as what went on for Italian 90, but the win over England certainly caused an awakening, and it people woke up and said, wow, we've got a team, what a result. And some people did come out for the Dutch game. Now, it was very expensive. You didn't have Ryanair, and well, you might have had Ryanair, but they weren't cheap in those days. No. I can't remember. I think they might have been founded by Tony Ryan, maybe. There was certainly no Michael O'Leary in those days. And there was no way to fly cheaply. And certainly if you were flying last minute, you were paying through the nose. But some fans did pay through the nose to get out for the Dutch game. And after seeing the win over England. And so it certainly took off at home. And the pubs were packed for the Soviet and the Dutch game as well. And I will tell a story about a former colleague of mine in digital in Galway who genuinely had to be in the Netherlands. Digital had a place, I think it was Apeldoorn or someplace in the Netherlands. I can't remember exactly where it was at the time. But he had a meeting on the Monday morning, June 13th. And, of course, he flew on the Saturday and got a train to Stuttgart and was due to get a train back on to the Netherlands. Sorry, it was Nijmegen, actually, was the town that the plant was in. So he was meant to get a train from Stuttgart to Nijmegen after the game. The game kicked off at 3:30 local time, so there was plenty of time to get back to the station and everything. And when he sobered up after the win over England, on Tuesday morning, he calls back to work. And luckily, he managed to keep his job. He was a bit... But they did understand. So.
I bet it was probably the beginning of that, though, wasn't it? When lots of people suddenly decided, you know what, I'm just going to go on the RAS instead of going into work.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm sure lots of people missed work on that Monday morning. it was just, I mean, in Stuttgart, just everyone went mad as well. It was just incredible. Actually, we didn't end up that drunk because a lot of the bars were closed and it was actually quite difficult. So we actually walked a lot of ways around Stuttgart, asking loads of local people where we might get a drink because of England A and England B and all the hooligans in town, a lot of the places shut up. And but we did find a place that was open and got a couple of drinks. And but we actually, if I remember rightly, we set out for Hanover. We had actually had to hire a car. Our car was banjaxed. We'd leave the car in Stuttgart to be repaired and had to rent a car to drive around Germany then for the rest of the trip and picked up the car at the semi-final. We were back in Stuttgart for the second semi-final. And so we had to go and figure out car hire and on the Monday morning, and we went up to Hanover after that.
So did the car make it all the way back in the end?
it made it back in the end. I had to fly home again from Paris, so I had a return flight from Paris on the Sunday night. If I remember, the final was on a Saturday, and we got to Paris. I think it was the Sunday night. I had a Sunday night flight back to Dublin and got back to Galway for work on Monday morning. So I had 2 weeks, 10 days holidays.
Nice.
And but the car did make it home eventually. but it was already, I think it was 9 years old at that stage, and a lot of miles on the clock. So look, there was a lot of stuff in those days. I mean, we were staying in a tent in campsites in Hanover and Cologne. It was a bit rough and ready, but we got there. You
know? But I think those are the experiences among Irish fans that make the stories better, though, right? I mean, if you had it nice and cushy and you went to all these hotels and you stayed in hotels, blah, blah, you wouldn't have these stories. That's what makes it interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, we were very young as well. I mean, there were certainly fans on organized trips that were staying in hotels, but they would have paid through the... I mean, those trips would have been expensive, you know, in those days. And it just would have been out of reach. So I desperately wanted to go, and I could afford to go, albeit on borrowed money, in a tent. But if I was paying for a trip in those days, it would have just been out of reach as well. And it also meant I was able to get the 2 weeks of the tournament on the cheap, as opposed to a trip for 1 week, because I was never coming home without the team. And I mean, I'd always, for any tournament, I always make plans. Either I stay for as long as I can, or else make allowances that if we do get through, if we do keep going on, that there's an option there, there's a way to stay.
Yeah, yeah. What about Jack Charlton then afterwards? Is this a vindication for him, and some of the criticism beforehand that, you know, this wasn't the way kind of Irish football teams play, but all of a sudden now we're going to tournaments, we're competing, we're beating teams, and we didn't make it out of the group, but we still gave a fantastic account of ourselves. Is there justification there for him afterwards?
Absolutely. I mean, Jack and the team came home as heroes. I mean, there was huge celebrations. It's one of the things I missed, obviously, but there was huge celebrations in Dublin. Hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets. It was certainly seen as being hugely successful, and it was just bad luck that a great Dutch team caught us with a few minutes to go. I mean, we did play so well in that tournament and came oh so close to going further, and who knows, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we know, there was more tournaments to come, unbelievably. You know, you wait your whole life, Gary, for one tournament and three come along at the same time. But yeah, fantastic. Gary, thanks very much. We're going to leave it there. And then I think the next time for the Irish team, it'll be obviously qualifying for the World Cup in Italy and that kind of experience, which I'm sure you've got an inordinate amount of stories from as well.
Absolutely.
But Gary, absolutely fantastic. That was really enjoyable. I loved hearing your own story as well in those tournaments. So thanks very much.
Cheers. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this week's show. On next week's show, we'll be looking at the 90s in the League of Ireland, including St. Pat's, Cork City, Derry City, Dundalk, Bray Wanderers, Bohemians, and lots, lots more. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, and Amazon Music, as well as a host of other platforms too. Share the show on your social media platforms to help others learn more about the history and heritage of Irish football. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club. It's our heritage, it's our game. Until then, bye for now.